Welcome to the Inside College Soccer Podcast, bringing together some of the best college soccer-related people to your earbuds, from coaches to players and beyond. So, thank you for tuning in. The Inside College Soccer Podcast is brought to you by Sports Recruiting USA, the college soccer experts. Now, enjoy the show.
Hi, everyone. My name is Chris Cousins, and welcome to Inside College Soccer. Just before we get going with the podcast, I've got Don Williams here, my colleague. I just want to talk about the event that we've got in Las Vegas in February. Don, let's find out more information. Can you tell us all about this Las Vegas Goalkeeper Showcase, please? What's it all about?
So Andre and Luciano and I were talking about, you know, the problems with identifying goalkeepers at games is that they often don't get a lot of action. So we wanted to be able to showcase the goalkeepers' abilities before the tournament starts, and then coaches can identify the goalkeepers that they want to go see and track throughout the event.
So how's the day going to run, or how's the event going to run?
So we'll bring them in the night before, 5 to 7. We're not going to beat them up, but we're going to allow them to show a little bit of everything: chips, crosses, driven balls, distribution. We'll be very careful on the 1v1s. We don't want to hurt them, but handling, shot stopping, tips, allow them to be able to showcase everything that they can do for an hour or two before the college coaches, the ones that are eligible to shake hands with coaches and meet them. They'll be able to do that, introduce themselves beforehand, and then coaches can then make notes, go out the next day and next couple of days and track those goalkeepers.
What are the coaches saying about this event? I mean, I've heard positive things, but what have you been hearing?
Yeah, we did just a little release, not even on social media, not even really saying what it was and what was involved. And we already had coaches reaching out going, yeah, let me know when it is. We want to come. Because coaches also know through their experience that this is a problem, identifying goalkeepers during games, because they may not get a lot of action.
So how do you sign up for this?
So there'll be a link attached to this, and then you can always go to www.srusasoccer.com, click on events, and you'll see a link to be able to sign up for this. Primarily, this will be SRUSA clients who will just be covering insurance, but for everybody else, it's $125 for the event. We're going to be flying in staff from throughout California to come in, and then Andre will be there from Las Vegas. All goalkeepers on staff running the event, so we can make sure that there's a quality opportunity for goalkeepers to show themselves at the event.
All right, everybody, we are back live with another episode of Inside College Soccer at the convention, and we just got back. Steve Rollins is here with me. Hey, Steve.
Hi, John. How are you?
You guys should know Steve. He's been on episodes with me and Erica. I've done Erica Sutter's podcast, Fit Soccer Queen, but she's with us too, Erica.
Excited to be here.
Thanks for coming on. This might be your first time like on our podcast Inside College Soccer, is it?
I think it might be the
second
and
one.
And then like the seventh time altogether. Just
yeah, we've been trading being guests on each other's podcasts back and forth. And of course, Steve did that really good episode that we did with yours, Erica, on academics.
Yeah, the high academic schools in the Northeast.
Yeah, that was a really good one. And so Steve and I were sitting down watching Erica's session, and we all three said, "Oh, we need to talk about this." And the concept is, so in the United States, in all the courses I've been to, they talk about technical, tactical, physical, and mental. But one of the coaching schools that I grew up studying under was the Dutch school, and At IAX, they talk about TIPS, technique, insight, personality, and speed. So technical, technique, same thing we're talking about pretty much. Insight, tactics, how you see the game, how you interpret, how your brain interprets. And then personality, the psychosocial piece of the personality, mentally, toughness, all that. And then speed versus physical. And I like the way the Dutch talk about the speed rather than talking about physical. Because, you know, people talk about, I don't know, would Kareem Abdul-Jabbar have been a great soccer player? You know, might not have been, right? Might not have had the right tools. So, great physical ability. But, and I'm reaching way back on that one, aren't I, Kareem? Showing how much I watch basketball. But, speed. And soccer, I always talk about guys, I talk about change of pace being the difference maker between the great players and the good players. Right? How quickly you can go from 0 to 60, 60 to 0, cut, stop, change directions, lose players, catch players, all of that stuff. And in soccer, that happens in about a 15-meter span. At max. At max. A lot of times it's 5 yards. It's the ball 5 yards between you and me. Who gets there first? If my team gets to that loose ball first, 95% of the time, good chance I've got a lot more possession. Gives me more chances to score. Gives you less chances to score. We probably win more games, right?
Yeah.
So that was kind of the talk we had had earlier. And Erica, your session here was about speed, right?
Yeah, so absolute speed, which is speed off the ball, and top end speed, so being able to get your mile per hour number.
Right, so how does that relate to the pro players, let's say? So if I'm saying my kid wants to play at the pro level, my kid wants to play at the Power 5 level, my kid wants to play at the North Carolina level, the Stanford level, the whatever level, I want to play at that level. I don't, what are those kids running at speeds? What kind of speeds are at the top level?
Men's and we are opening a can of worms. So I'm just going to start off by saying a lot of high school players that have never done speed before, and they're coming in with a baseline of usually under 16, 17 miles per hour. And that's like the average speed for the average high school soccer player. But girls who are playing at that D1 level are over 18 miles per hour. Some are at 19 miles per hour, which is excellent for that age. And a lot of players just aren't, they're not training it appropriately, and they're not making the time to do it. And you had tweeted that they need to be owning that development and working at it on their own, because a lot of coaches aren't implementing it and they're not getting it from the practice week. But there has to be time made for speed at least twice a week year round, and then bump it up to 3 in the off season. And you can improve anyone by a couple miles per hour. They just have to stay consistent with it. And then once they mature and start to advance in their speed training and they have several years under their belt, they'll start to just kind of reach their top speed. And then at that point, it's just about incremental improvements when they're at that college level. But you can absolutely build a high school player's speed if it's a new stimulus and they're going through their growth spurt and they're still plastic at that time. So that's a good time to train it, but not a lot of people are willing to do that.
So the tweet we were talking about, I said a couple days ago, if you're in high school with a goal to play at a big name program, winning natties and playing pro, and then you're not dialing in nutrition, speed training, strength training, sports psych, wall work, juggling, fitness, film study, you're behind hundreds of players who are. You know, 500, probably 500 to 1,000 kids trying to come in that are working on this stuff every day. And if you choose not to, and you're only training 3 days a week with your club team and you're playing one day a week and you're not doing any of this stuff, I'm not saying it's impossible, I'm saying you're behind. There's kids out there doing it. And unless you're an athletic freak and phenom, remember a guy named Jack Del Rio?
Oh, the linebacker.
Yes, the linebacker. He went to Hayward High School down the street from me, one of our rivals, and same year as me. Graduate. And the rumor amongst all the other football players is Jack always swore he never lifted weights in high school. And if that's the case, he's an athletic phenom. To get that big, that strong, that fast without doing strength training may or may not have been true, but you see the point of what I'm saying is, if that's what you can do, then you are... Remember Troy Dyack, who played for the Quakes? Troy was a man-child at 13. big, strong, muscles, hair on his chest at 13, 14, and, you know, was making Olympic teams. And I know he wasn't doing much weight training. So unless your kid's that, then we need to try to maximize what we have, what God gave us, right? And so what can we maximize that out at? If I do everything, we'll talk about what's right and how to do it. But if I did everything right from what God gave me, and assuming I'm fit, I'm assuming I can run, I'm not overweight, what can I maximize? What can I expect in gains? 4%, 5%, 20%? What can I expect in gains?
Well, it's important to be clear that speed is about 70% genetic and then 30% control. So we can absolutely control what we can. We can get players a couple miles per hour faster, but realistically, if you're starting with like a 15 mile per hour girl, she's never going to be a D1 19 mile per hour. She just got bad genetics. Maybe her parents were endurance athletes, so she's has more of the slow twitch muscles. Maybe her body type isn't good for being a fast runner. There's so many factors that go into it. So for that player, they can still improve, but it's important where they know their level is. Are they a D3 player or are they a D1 player? And I've talked to a lot of D1 players that when you get to that level, everyone's pretty technically and tactically sound, but the difference is the pace in their play off the ball, so the absolute speed, but also being able to think fast too and combine that with your absolute speed, which Steve can speak more to. And you do need both, but I will say that the top D1 players are extremely fast.
So Steve, somebody out there is listening to this and going, see, you people only talk about fast players. What about the kid who can think quickly? What about the kid who processes the game quickly? What about the kid who's so technical that they can play one touch, two touch, they can play quicker? Now, the reason I thought it would be interesting to have you here is because of your background when you started getting into coaching, who you studied under and where you played, right? Which was where?
So I was fortunate enough as a youth to play at Ajax for a couple of years before they realized that they had made a mistake and sent me home. And then, you know, later on in life, I got the opportunity to go coach there with, you know, friends of mine who were now in their 30s and stuff and coaching there. And I was able to spend a few years working with them. And we just look at speed, not so much differently, but there's different components. So there's definitely the physical component of speed. And that tends to manifest itself in the game when you're not on the ball. Right. If you're talking just how fast I can pick them up and put them down, there's a segment of the game that deals with that. And, you know, in the TIPS program, if you look at, you know, each of the segments, I think speed has like 13 different characteristics. Some of them are pure foot speed. Some of them are speed of thought, speed of play, and stuff like that. So there's a speed of play part where how fast can I move the ball into a more advantageous position. Right? So, and a lot of that has to do with insight and your body prep and that aspect of the game. And then there's like, how fast can I read the game, right? So in the tips, more of the insight part. So if I can leave two steps before you and we're only running 10 yards, I really don't care how fast you are, I will beat you to the ball.
Right.
Now, when you're playing at the top levels, those margins become ever so tighter.
Let's be clear, Steve. We are talking to everybody. We're talking about the top level.
Yeah.
We're talking about the kids in the country who have the top 50 schools on their list.
Right.
So we're talking about 80% of the kids in the country that have these schools on their list. Right? We're talking about what does it take to be a player that succeeds, not sits on the bench,
right,
but succeeds in that environment and then probably gets talked about at some point of playing at the next level, the pro level. Sum up those kids.
So what it is, and Erica, you know, touched on this before, you know, every kid who's going into, you know, your top D1 programs or playing at the professional academies, they're all 18, 19 already, right? The difference between 18.1 and 18.4 is really what we're talking about. And that's where a lot of the speed training comes into play, because the difference between 18.1 and 18.4 over 20 yards is about, if my math is correct, and you can correct my math if it's wrong, it's about three steps. give or take, over 20 yards. Just think about, you know, watching a game, and over 20 yards, if I can get 2 to 3 steps on you, I'm winning 90% of those balls. Am I getting 2 or 3 steps on you in 5 yards? No. That's, so then the balance changes from the physical to the... But the longer we have to go, the more the physical aspect weighs on the result, as opposed to the other aspects, you know, the tactical and the insight and the stuff like that. So it's a big part of the game, and we shouldn't confuse that the, oh, you know, well, when I talk speed, I only talk about, you know, speed of play. No, there's definitely an aspect of the game which is, you know, speed of foot. You know, like I said, if I can read the game before you and I can get 2 steps in 5 yards, I'm beating you every time. In 20, 30 yards, now it's a different conversation.
So what does the science, current science, tell us that we know from the moment my brain says, do this, to the moment that my body does that and explodes over those critical 3 to 5, 6 yards? How are we training that? What are we doing? How are we taking that moment of making that decision, that stimulus, and then getting my body to do it?
Yeah.
Can we increase that? Is that what we're talking about?
Yeah, I think what people mix up with speed off the ball, so that's your top end mile per hour number, and then speed on the ball and the cognitive component, is they think that we need to like replace one with the other and like lean one way. And there's so many different schools of thought. There's Raymond Verheyen, I can never pronounce his last name, who's more about like everything on the ball, small-sided games. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you have like the Mike Boyles, who are like, okay, we need to do everything off the ball, conditioning and speed. But I think we can reach a happy medium where we optimize both. And that's why I like Steve's work, because we can't just have fast movers and fast absolute speed players. They also have to be able to think fast. And then your players who are a little bit slower, who might be like an 18.1 mile per hour as opposed to an 18.4, what if they're a fast thinker and they can be a step ahead? So I think we have to just try and optimize both for all of our players the best we can. And I'm just curious your thoughts on just how to manipulate small-sided games to get the cognitive load increased and like the conditioning and then just like the overall speed of play, because we've talked before that most small-sided games are not well designed in the current youth club soccer team. They're just not intense enough, they're not preparing for game load enough. So I think it's important that we touch on that in the soccer specific, and then the speed off the ball is a separate session. But the small-sided game programming is critical with this. So I love your conversation.
So for me, and the only part of your conversation that like perked my ears a little bit was when you said it was in the design. I definitely disagree that it's in the design. I think it's more in the execution, right? Because, you know, what's the design? The space is this. We're going to do 3+3+2, and this is the, you know, intensity of the game. So the design is pretty simple. And I think most people think that they can take the design and put it into play, and that miraculously a bunch of 13-year-olds are going to play at the intensity, that they're going to keep whatever your principles of play are intact. And so I think it's less about the design and more about the execution. You know, if you're a coach and you have certain principles of play, from the second a kid walks on to the field in his warm-up to the second they leave, those principles have to be in there. You know, do I want the ball to the far foot? How many times are we scanning the field? You know, are we looking in a progression, right? Some people go, you know, long, short, support. Right? What's our progressions? How do we integrate the third person run? And so all of those things have to be in all of those small-sided games, and that will help with the speed of thought and the speed that the ball moves. where small-sided games tend to lack in its efficiency is when we're talking about pure physical aspects of the game. Like, it's very difficult in a small-sided game to do 20, 30-yard sprints. Right?
Right.
You can do certain exercises where you're going from grid to grid and stuff and sprint a little bit, but you're generally at a higher load already. You're generally already fatigued. So while those things add aspects to your games, what they don't add is the pure speed training.
Right.
That enables you to get that top mile an hour done because you're already in a fatigue state.
Here's what I'd never thought about until today when I was listening to your session. You said that true speed training, which, let's be clear, right, is done fresh. It's fresh, right? So it's not sprinting for 30 seconds, rest for 30 seconds. Sprinting for 30 seconds, rest for 30 seconds. That's not that.
That's more anaerobic capacity.
That's right. Yeah, but a lot of speed, 85%. A lot of quote-unquote speed training, right. air quotes going on there, folks. Speed training is done under that guise of I'll make a 120-yard sprint. I'll come back in 45 seconds. I'll get 5 more seconds rest. I'll do 100, and this is going to make me faster.
Right.
But that's conditioning.
Yeah, and that can still be a valuable drill if we're building like an aerobic base for like the 120s, like the tempo runs. If we're doing like a 1-to-1 work to rest, like a 30-second on, 30-second off, that could be a good anaerobic capacity drill. But
that's not
speed,
what we're talking about. We're talking about
top
maximum
speed.
Velocity over a period of what we said today, 5 to 8 seconds, 5 to 6 seconds,
less than 6 seconds,
than 6 seconds.
It's, 3 to 5 seconds.
And then resting for as long as
5 minutes.
And people are going to go, yeah, but in a half hour session, what do I get, like 6 sprints in?
Well, two.
How is this going
to
work?
Two a couple times a week is enough to get a good stimulus, and then you accumulate that over time and you get good speed exposure. But I think that's the problem, is like when I said in the presentation today, you need to take that rest. People's minds were blown. They're like, what do you mean?
Can we juggle? Can we juggle?
Everyone wants to do a filler. Like, can we do burpees? Can we juggle?
The answer was no, by the way. Don't.
I know.
Don't juggle.
So I like to look at other experts when it comes to speed, and I look at the track guys.
Right.
Because they're working with the fastest mile per hour in the world.
And
ideally, if we want to train the central nervous system to do its job, we want to train on a track in spikes. That's the fastest you'll get your athletes to run, and with the wind.
Right.
But realistically, soccer players can't do that, so we're doing it on turf and cleats, which is fine, but if we're going to do that, it has to be that less than 6 second effort, and in between those efforts, we're resting long so that we can run as fast as we can the next time. We want the time between those two or three sprints, whatever you do, to be very similar. If I had a player run a 10-meter fly as fast as they could, they should, A, be gassed after that effort. They should be, like, totally out of breath, and, like, their nervous system needs that 5-minute break.
Right.
You can't hold back on that.
Right.
And I always ask my players, like, could you run that 10-meter fly at that mile per hour if you ran it again in even 90 seconds? And they say, no way. That's how hard you're going, but I don't think people train, especially soccer players, they don't train extreme enough when it comes to speed training.
Right.
And they don't want to make the time for it. They don't want to do the long rest, but it's like, if you want to improve that, then you have to make time, and you have to be patient and not try and put in all this busy work. Otherwise, you're hindering the
But my players need more endurance. It's the second half they're getting gassed. It's late in the game. And that blew me away is that the science seems to be showing that speed training does help with endurance. And that surprised me.
It surprises me every day.
It feels counterintuitive to me.
Right. Yeah, and it should, but there's more coming out on high-intensity training and sprint work for increasing mitochondria in the cells, and then myoglobin, which delivers more oxygen to the muscles. And you'll actually find that your players who can run a 19 mile per hour, they'll never fail you in the final minutes of the game. Your slow players will, though. they will poop out on you at the end of the game. But this is where what Steve's talking about, it needs to be supplemented. We need to use small-sided games for technical, tactical, and then for a conditioning effect. And you kind of changed my mind on this as far as, like, the way it's set up, the small-sided games. Like, usually increasing the pitch dimension and having less players increases the conditioning effect. But I think you're right that it really comes down to how the coach executes it and just, like, their energy within that small-sided game. And I was always fascinated with Tony Strudwick and how he coached his small-sided games. And it wasn't joystick coaching by any means. It was just like he was on them, like get their heart rates up and constantly be like head on a swivel. So yeah, like what are your thoughts on how a coach should increase the conditioning
piece? So we had spoken about this earlier, and I don't have the science behind it, but I truly believe the brain stops long before the legs give out. And so when we're talking about, you know, players at the highest level being able to scan the field every 3 to 4 or 5 seconds, you know, depending upon, you know, the level of player, that stops long before they stop running.
Oh, I absolutely agree with that. I don't know the science on it either, but watch any player start to play and you start to watch the cognitive decisions start to deteriorate,
right?
And you get him into overtime, now it's, oh, made a mistake. I got him too tight. I marked him too tight. He got him behind me. It's because the brain stops working.
And I know, you know, Todd and Tovo uses, and I'm going to use some of their terminology, so, you know, I'm saying that I'm stealing it right up front. So he talks about being on. And being on is not about running. Being on is, you know, going through that soccer process or soccer action repeatedly, 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 repeatedly. And Raymond Verheyen in Keep It Simple, I think that's the name of his book, speaks too well. It's how often you can go through that process. And that process is cognitive. So if I'm scanning, making a decision, and then executing that decision, and I can do that, and at the high school level, I generally ask that it's, you know, once every 8 seconds. If I'm doing that once every 8 seconds, that process is giving me my physical stamina, and it's also giving me my cognitive stamina. So, you know, for me, everything we do has that process, and we want it to be every 8 seconds. So, again, by training the mind, my opinion, you're also training the physical stamina part of it, and it's good in the small side of games. The other thing we talk about is intensity, right? How often can you do it within a minute? And I like to use the music term staccato, right? If a coach can be out there and be very staccato with their instructions, and their instructions aren't take it on the right foot, take it on the left foot, do this, but their instructions could be, are we scanning? Are we taking it on our far foot? Heads up. You know, things that are reminding players of the things that we want them to do rather than instructing them how to do it. And we do it at that very staccato, quick pace. They will start playing that way. And another thing that Eric and myself have spoken about, when I deal with the really young kids, the 6 to 9-ish age, I play music. Right?
Oh, really?
I play music. And the reason for that is because the kids will play to the beat.
Like electronic dance music? Like what?
I'll play whatever they want. Like, I'm an old country ballad guy. They don't want to hear
Justin Bieber.
Meryl Hot Aggie. But I let them, you know, because the kids get into it, you know. Oh, you know, Susie, today we're going to do your playlist. And as long as it's upbeat, you know, I don't want to hear any ballads. But as long as it's upbeat, the kids will get excited and they'll bounce to the beat and they'll play to the beat and stuff. And that keeps the rhythm that we want them to do. And the younger kids enjoy that more.
Explain for our listeners real quick the environment you're talking about, though, right? What environment are you talking about when you're talking about training the kids with music and all of that?
So
any team in any environment at any time?
So I'm really talking the real young ones that are still in the grassroots. So under 9 years of age.
There we go.
Under 9 years of age. So, you know, we're not, hey, if somebody has success with it with their college team, you know, God bless them. It's not, you know, how.
Because I was picturing that with my college team, and I'm going, yeah, I don't think I could have done that with them.
Right. But we're talking 6 to 9 years old where,
right,
you know, so much of the game is about fun and enjoyment, and so give them some songs and some music that they like, and they'll sing along, and they'll actually play to the beat.
Interesting.
That's adorable. I love that.
Yeah, I do too. I never would have thought about that ever. You Steve does these. Well, you live in New Jersey, right?
I do.
And you've got these open, kind of almost drop-in sessions of students that come in, and you're doing it for nothing.
Yeah, so it's, you know, I do it. It's for free. Not so much drop-in. I do some planning, so I like people to let me know that they're coming. Yeah. But other than that, yeah, I mean, we run through 40 to 50 kids a week. We're running them at, you know, 14 to 18 at a time. And, you know, we don't charge for it. They can come and go as they please. I can say that every 23 that we have has, you know, is committed to a college program. I think I only have 124 left that is not.
Wow.
So these are generally higher level players. And I don't think I'm doing anything special for the higher level players, other than higher level players tend to seek out extra.
Is it mainly small sided games? Are you doing technical skill work, or do you have them do that on their own with a wall?
So technical skill work is, so small sided games is technical skill work.
Right.
Right. So if you're in a small sided game and you're receiving the ball and it bounces in the air, 9 times out of 10, your toe's too low. And I will tell them that.
Right? But so, is there a way they work on it on their own if they're not doing it well within the small sided game?
I may give them something to do on their own and stuff, but you know, we make technical corrections in our small sided game.
That's interesting. That's kind of the opposite of what you see with a lot of skills training now. It's a lot of
Two cones and two players passing it
right
between the cones, and receive it with your left, play it with your right, receive it with your right, play it with your left, receive it with the right, play it with your left, receive it with your right, play it with your right, players passing it back and forth between two cones. You know, I'm not saying everywhere, I'm saying a good chunk, am I wrong?
Yeah,
a good
chunk
of that's
Instagram.
Our technical training, right? Or we're dribbling in and out of cones, or we're, right?
Yeah.
Which is something that is a kind of a hot topic discussion amongst coaches on Twitter and Instagram, and as we see more and more videoed sessions, plays being put out, right?
But there's nothing inherently wrong with that.
Okay.
Right? You know, so when we're, when I was working at the academy, there were things that you did with technical trainers. There were things that you did with physios. Speed training was done with the physio. We didn't do that at team training. In team training, we worked on small-sided games and the tactical and the insight and everything. So they're all pieces to the puzzle.
There you go.
And it's just a matter of how much you value each of them. None of them ever goes completely away, and none of them is ever the silver bullet to success. They're all necessary pieces. But it's like, you know, when I do team training, right, I don't do speed training. Why? Because I only have X amount of time, and I can't fit it in. Can I sit there and say, okay, we're going to do speed training now, come 15 minutes early? Or I'm going to supplement, you know, twice a week. Maybe I'm not going to dual force training and stuff. So instead of doing that, which is 10 minutes or so in the beginning of a session, I particularly like it for girls because they don't like the contact.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why. They just tend to shy away from the physical contact. But, you know, add speed training in there. But there's different aspects to make the player well-rounded. And I think it's important that we say, hey, look, I don't, in my training, use unimposed drills. It's not to say that you can't use them or that it's wrong to use them. It's just a different part of the puzzle. As long as you do it well, you know, there's room for everything, you know. You're an expert at one-on-one training. You can't do the stuff I do. Why? You probably need 4 or 5 kids there. But, you know, if somebody wants to say, hey, I want to be better at this one technique, and you one-on-one with a coach, there's a benefit to that. And they do that at the top academies. They just don't do it generally with the team. Right? This is stuff that they're even doing on their own with their technical trainers and speed training with the physios and, you know, the assistant coaches and stuff. They're working more on the tacticals and
in that type of small sided games.
Stop being so reasonable and not bashing every other coach on the internet like everybody else is doing, Steve. What is wrong with you? Just to bash coaches, right? No, you're being reasonable. You're understanding, I want everybody to understand that there's a bit and a piece to a lot of the things we go see out there when we're looking at it.
You have to develop a complete player, and it comes back to your tweet that everyone got mad at. You need to work on your skills, you need to do your speed and strength training, sometimes outside of practice, you need to work with a nutritionist or get that dialed in. There's just so many things that make a high-performing player that not many are willing to do, and you call them out on that. And
well, and I would say it's not for every kid. Look.
Yeah.
If your kid doesn't want it, people went, how much more can you stress these kids out? How much more? My kid's already studying, and my kid's already going to band practice, and my kid doesn't need all that extra stress. Playing on a national championship level and professionally, we're not saying it's for every player in the world. We're not saying everybody's even capable of it. I 1,000% was not physically capable of ever playing at those levels. As much as I tried, as much as I worked out, as much as I trained, as much as I lifted, as much as I ran, as much as I trained on my own, as much as I did wall work, as much as I played soccer, tennis, as much as I went to different training sessions, I reached a peak, and my son did too, and thousands and hundreds of thousands have reached their peak. And it's still not good enough. No matter, this goes back to a tweet that you said at one time. That something about just because you do everything perfectly and do it right, and it doesn't mean that it's automatically going to guarantee you success, something like that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was actually going off of another tweet you had.
Probably.
I think it was the one when you said everyone will do everything right, they'll do all the extra trainings, they'll play for all the latest acronyms, ECNL and GA, and they're still not going to make it to the D1 school they wanted to play at. And I'll give an example, and that's myself. I was getting recruited to play at D1 schools, but I don't think I was at the level to be an impact player at D1 school. I don't know. I'll never know because I didn't try.
Right.
But when I grew up, I was doing speed and strength training. I was doing my own technical training. I was on Bethesda Soccer Club, the best team in the state at the time. I was doing everything right, and I decided to go D3, and that's how I was realistic with myself. Could I have gone to play at Maryland? Yes, but I don't know if I would have gotten a lot of time. So it's like you can do all you want and everything you think that's going to get you into a top 25 school, but sometimes it just doesn't work out, and that's just not the level you're at. Rachel Cambronera, who I just interviewed on Soccer Queens, former Wake Forest player, she was the number one recruit in, I think it was 2010. I don't even remember what she said, but she was getting recruited by like Anson Dorrance and all the top schools, and she chose Wake Forest. But from my conversation with her, like, she also is doing everything right. Nutrition, speed, strength, technical. I think she also was on Bethesda Soccer Club at some point, but she said that she was just a genetically good soccer player since like age 4. Like, she just had it. She had a good soccer IQ, and like, she made it to that level. I think some people have it and some don't, and with some you can only train so much and reach a certain peak, like you said.
Yeah.
And it's just being realistic with people.
Yeah. Perfect. You're going to reach a max at some point. In almost every aspect of our lives, we have a maximum capacity for whatever we do, and then you say, I just can't do it anymore, and it's okay, and it doesn't mean these kids are failures. And I think that's all three of us, I know, feel the same way. We're here to help. We're here to alleviate some of the pain, not add to it. And we want people to know that if you're doing everything right, probably going to end up, if you shoot for Mars, maybe you land on the moon type of thing, right? Maybe you don't quite make it to Mars, but you land on the moon. And that's farther than most people made it. There's only 7% statistically of the high school age kids in this country that are playing this game, soccer, that end up making it to a school. But if I go to any under 14 team out there in the country, and we say raise your hand, a huge percent are probably going to raise their hand and say, I want to play in college, right? and under 1,506 is still a pretty big number,
right.
But still only 7% make it. Why? All of these reasons we were talking about, right?
I wouldn't say, too, like, if people, they work so hard and check all the boxes and they don't make it to that top level that they wanted, I wouldn't say any of that was a waste.
No.
Like, they at least learn discipline along the way, and I think people forget that. They forget to enjoy that process, and they're like, well, I didn't reach, like, my dream school. It was, like, all for
like
nothing.
Like, I'm a failure.
And it's like, no, you had great experiences. You had great friendships and team memories, and you learned what you were made of in speed training and in the weight room. You learned all these things and habits, and that's valuable, too. But everyone just wants that, like, result, and it's not guaranteed.
Yeah, very interesting. Anything you want to add?
So, I think
any thoughts.
You know, one of the things that I wanted to add, and you know, I'll give a little bit of, you know, what I do personally, is, you know, as a coach, you know, sometimes the best things I can do is know that I don't know enough. You know, so when we're talking about speed training, yeah, there's probably a couple of things that I could add to my practice, but am I ever going to be a speed training coach? No shot. I don't know enough about it. And so my own children don't go to me for strength and conditioning and speed training. They just don't. I don't know enough about it. My personal kids have a technical trainer that they will see from time to time to work on that. So it's okay not to be everything to everybody.
I like that.
Right? And
it's honest. I like that.
You know, just because, you know, like, I can go and work at a local grassroots club, and I try to tell the people, you know, and people sit there and say, well, what does IACS do here? Well, you know what? IACS had 5 physios, 6 data analysts, 7 coaches for the U14 team.
Incredible.
You know, so...
resources.
You don't have those types of resources, so sometimes you just got to say, hey, look, this is our spot, and we can do things for you to help you get to that next level, but we're not everything at that next level. And then the level after that, you know, as good as a lot of the college programs here are, they're not the professional programs in Europe.
Right.
Right?
Right.
So, and they're not trying to be.
Right.
So why, as a grassroots coach, are you trying to be, you know, have to give the same experience to a kid who's going to UNC, who's at, you know, your local club. So right. It's okay not to be able to check every single box yourself.
No, and if it was, you wouldn't have a job, Erica. If we could all figure out, right? I did the same thing with my kid. It's like I had coached a little bit in pro, and I've been coaching in college a long time, and I've done a lot of training. And I had the same thing with my kid. It's like, yeah, but that guy's the expert on speed and strength. That's the guy to talk to. That guy is the expert on sports psych, not me.
Right.
I read a book. I gave you the same book. You and I now have the same knowledge, son. And it's still not enough. And you got to go talk to that guy.
Yeah.
And you got to go talk to that
nutritionist,
guy.
Like
and
Lindsay.
And nutritionist.
Like,
yeah.
You know enough to be deadly, but it's like...
Oh, I was afraid. I was afraid I knew so much about... Or so little about so much that all I would do is make it worse. If I started, it's like, oh.
I knew enough to really screw it up.
I read this and I read that, and why don't you try this and I make it worse? I'd rather just go get it done right.
Yeah.
It's the old saying, you can have it cheap, you can have it fast, or you can have it done right. Pick 2 of the 3.
Yeah.
Pick 2 of the 3. You want instant success? In this area? In development? Soccer area? This is athletic development, I guess we can expand it to. There's almost no instant success. There's no, what do you call it, silver bullet. There's no silver bullet. There's no one thing that's like, now I'm on the national team today because I went and did this thing.
Yeah.
This has been good, guys. This has been good. Steve, you have anything to plug?
I have nothing to plug.
You're with us. I guess you can plug us.
I am with SRUSA, and I do help kids getting to school. I do my own training out in the Princeton area. But
is there somewhere that people can get a hold of you if they want to get a hold of you anything in the Princeton, New Jersey general area?
So I'm fairly active on Twitter. My handle is
you don't know your handle?
It's softtop67.
That's it.
I think that's it.
At soft
See,
top
Don and I know
you see
it.
Well, it's always that. Even when I met you, it's like, soft top. So let me see. He must have a convertible soft
top. That's exactly
top.
What it was.
You
either
have
convertible.
Your
either
that or his IX.
My profile picture is.
Either that or he's getting older and out of shape and his top is soft.
No, maybe it's both? That's the middle.
Oh, the middle. That's right. And then, Erica, how does people get a hold of you?
I'm on Twitter as well, at FitSoccerQueen, and I get a lot of visitors down in Tampa, so if you're ever down there, just connect with me and we'll do a training.
And she's got a book?
Yes, The Strong Female Athlete.
Where do they get that?
Amazon.
That makes it easy. Yeah. Amazon. And you've also got some other pamphlets and some other stuff and some other...
Just
right?
The book for now.
Just the book for now, okay. Well, and then you've got a podcast.
Yes.
And how do they find the podcast?
So it's on my YouTube channel, the Soccer Queens Podcast, and it's just a lot of different coaches, performance coaches, and nutritionists who work with teenage girls.
This has been fun. Yeah.